Sister Joan Chittister is one of the most remarkable people I have ever known, and I think that anyone that knows her would say she's one of the most remarkable people they've ever met. She is a very well-known author. She's an activist in the areas of human rights and peace and justice and ecumenism. She is a scholar on contemporary religious life in the context of Roman Catholicism and Christianity, and also well beyond it. And she talks extensively and with great understanding and insight about women, church, and society. She's the co-chair of the Women's Global Peace Initiative. She is a sister of the Order of St. Benedict and was prioress of the community of Benedictine sisters at Mount St. Benedict in Erie, Pennsylvania, where she still is a member. Former president of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, and the author of countless books, any one of which I can assure you would be more than worth picking up.
Yeah.
We're really glad that you're here, Joan, and let me just kick it right off, since this is a series of conversations with members of the International Interreligious Peace Council. You've been involved in the Peace Council since its beginning in 1995, and I've been asking each of the folks on these calls if they can recall an experience with the group that was particularly meaningful. So let me toss you that question.
Well, I won't be surprised to learn that other people might have said the same thing. I think our time in Chiapas, in the jungles, with that small community of Indians who were standing up against the whole Western corporate establishment, who wanted their land, who wanted its access, who wanted the freedom to use it as they could, and who were willing to introduce any degree of terror on women and children, not on armed men, on women and children to intimidate them. What it did for me was, in flesh and blood, in a very different way than anything before it, it confirmed all the rest of my life. I don't see how you can be anywhere else with any kind of integrity and not speak for peace when you've seen a situation like that. I'll never forget it. I'll always be grateful for it in a most uncomfortable way.
It was for me as well. It was an unforgettable experience. And a couple of the other members of the Peace Council have also harkened back to Chiapas in their recollections. Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up the whole question of peace and justice, and our topic for today is related very directly to that. We're going to explore the principle of gender equity. Let's just begin simply, Joan, what is it? And why is it so important in the context of reshaping the human community?
Well, in the first place, if you look at the whole question of gender justice, you really have to understand that what is lacking is human justice for men as well as for women. We're trying to participate in the co-creation of a planet with half of the resources of the human race. We are, men have an unconscionable burden, actually, that they have accepted in the name of privilege. Men fail to recognize or even to explore often the effects of sexism on themselves. And so this inequitable situation continues at the peril of the human race. We are leaving out half the agendas of the world. They aren't meaningful. We've been told all our lives, father will do it for you. The men will know. Your brother has the answer. So the assumption is that the male agenda is the only significant agenda, and it is, worse, the universal agenda. So let's put it this way. If the female agenda is the same, is only subsumed in the male agenda, then there's no harm whatsoever in having us at the table, is it? We're not going to contradict anything anybody wants. It's all the same. But what if it's different? If it's different and we're not at the table, then both sides are suffering. Those decision makers in a patriarchal system are making decisions with half the information and half the insight. What you have in the female, in women, men have long decried this this whole notion that the reason you can't have women in any sensible discussion is because somehow or other they're not rational enough, that feeling has degraded their humanity. Men fail to realize that feeling is not non-thinking. It's another way of thinking. The reason you had the logistical problem you did after the Holocaust was because only logistics were brought to the question, and that was what to do with the bodies. We'll maintain this entire logistical approach to the suffering of the human race unless and until we introduce thinking into, and feeling rather, into all of our decisions. How will people feel about this? What will the world feel about this? How will I feel about this and participating in this? We have destroyed the only important part of the whole human enterprise. The very thing that bonds us together as human beings is how do we feel about one another. And women know how you feel about them. It's been very clear. It's been called invisibility. It's been called insignificance. It's been called nothingness. We know what the feelings are. But the feeling that comes back is you are belying your worship at the shrine of reason. There is nothing rational about that approach. We're also losing another whole style of leadership, this whole notion that somehow or other you nurture people rather than force them into things, that somehow or other you care about your decisions and the people who will be affected by them. That the whole question of the role and place and function of human compassion in a decision that involves human beings is being left out. We don't have, we have a century and a half of philosophers who basically ignored every single one of those issues and never asked before what was left out. The great progress is, and not that we have answered the question, but that we have finally admitted we have a question, and that until that question gets answered, gets responded to, gets attended to, at every level of every institution can possibly be fully human.
Well, let me bring up an institution there in that context. What about gender equity in the context of religious and spiritual life? And when we when we raise that topic in the context of the organized religions, we tend to look to issues of social and economic justice and so on, and to the roles that are available to women in the great religious traditions. In a while, I'm going to ask about more abstract, you know, the inclusion of a feminine perspective in our theological and spiritual reflection. But when we talk about issues of justice in the context of religious and spiritual life and the roles that are available to women, how has that changed over the past decade, if it has at all? And
little.
What do you expect in the next?
Well, let's put it this way. You have to deal with a couple things first. One is you have just brought it up, whether you've named it or not, and that is the insidious evil of the cosmetic. Everybody thinks that a great deal has changed for women in the last 50 years. I repeat, we know now that there is a question. Our answers to it are quite limited. Now, that leads to point number two. The eternal religious shame is that whatever has been done by a secular corporate community. That this whole question of the humanity and the full development of the human race with it has been created by God language. God is the only sexist that the church has recognized. God is the one who says that a woman isn't good enough, that there has to be a man standing between a woman and God, that God is the one who could draw water from a rock, but cannot, under circumstances, or will not work through the humanity that is female. So you have God being used as the reason for the oppression of women around the world by very religious people, who will then use God language to tell you how important women are and how beautiful they are and how the human race depends on them and where would we be without them, except we don't want them in this room, we don't want them at this table, we don't want them in this institution. And religion has maintained that up until 50 years ago, almost universally. We have some very prophetic small populations almost everywhere, but they haven't been listened to because institutions run better when they're being run by themselves. So we're now in a position where we have the secular society providing whatever advancement there is for women, by and large. You have religion, on the other hand, very, very concerned about those advances and resisting it in every arena. And you have God the bully, whose will this is. And yet there is nothing, certainly in the West, in the model of Jesus, that will confirm that. And there's very little in the early churches that will confirm that. So we have a real problem. Religion is a large piece of this. Religion is going to have to own its own sin where women are concerned. It's hard sometimes for the West to really understand this point of a discussion. As I was saying to somebody earlier, you might remember the remark of Harriet Tubman, that phenomenal African American woman who led slaves from the South to the North. And when they asked her what she had done, she said, "I have freed thousands of slaves, and I would have freed thousands more, except that they didn't know they were slaves." So you have a situation in the West where this cosmetic secular change of workloads, for instance, which is still masking, of course, lower wages, of the acceptance of women in the public arena, in workspaces, still masking the fact that though men can have typing pools and vacations and escalators and computers, a woman can't have daycare if she worked there. So we have this coverall of sin that looks like progress, and we are and the shame of the churches in not addressing it, and the misuse of God language to maintain it, and so we are completely oblivious, almost totally oblivious, as a people, as a civilization in the West, of what is happening to women in the rest of the world, who are far worse off than we are, despite the fact that what looks like equality, even in the West, lacks equity, lacks a real, genuine, theological, secular, corporate, human justice.
I think it's interesting that we're having this conversation in the context of an audience, or with an audience, many of whose members are part of the New Thought community, which is really an exception to the picture that you've painted, which I think is absolutely true. But here in the New Thought community, the great majority, as we were saying before, the majority of the clergy are women. It's the language has really evolved, and I'm saying this from the outside, looking in and being very impressed by the vitality of this growing community in that way.
That's fantastic. But now you should ask yourself the next question. Why are the majority of the clergy women? What happened to the men that women began to think differently in that community, and obviously, and in any other community? Where are they? If it's really New Thought,
do you know
where are the men?
This is Barbara speaking, and I am executive director of that group, and it reminded me of something that Young Chung had said last week. And we were speaking about ecofeminism and peace, but she was making the point that in the arena of religion, that what she believes firmly will happen to women in the future is that if they're denied roles of any stature in the churches and mosques as they have been in the past, that eventually they will take the best resources of that religious tradition and just go off somewhere and do it on their own. And I'm seeing some of that.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I think that's right. In fact, I think it's happening.
Yeah.
I think it's happening. Women are in the 70s, women howled. They screamed. They had meetings and petitions and protests. In the 80s, the movement was away from the public arena and a statement of claim or cause, to the development of groups of non-institutional groups. I began to say in the late 80s that the most subversive thing going on in the churches and in society today are book discussion groups.
Mm-hmm.
Women began to read together, and then pretty soon they began to pray together, and then they began to do works in the community together as women's groups, and then they began to be advocates and monitors as the whole thing, for instance, in the secular community again, the Women's Media Center. Who are you asking? Like, how did I get on this call? It can't be mainstream. It wouldn't be mainstream. We'd be asking a completely different kind of person, a man who came from religion, with the answers instead of the questions. So I think Young Chung is correct, and it's a dangerous correctness. But unless the churches begin to realize that they're losing the commitment of women in large numbers, and yet they are not losing necessarily all of the people in the pews, but people are taking their bodies to the liturgies and to the services and to the communal worship and withholding their minds and their hearts.
Well, you spoke before about God as the last sexist, the way God has been defined in the churches and in a patriarchal order, and I thought that was such a powerful statement. And when you talked about what was missing when women aren't at the table in general, and what's missing is that dimension of feeling, what's missing in theology when we have a God that is so starkly male, and even in the traditions that are that don't have a personal God in the Buddhist conception and so on, still very patriarchal spirit pervades. How would it be different if we began to introduce, not to the exclusion of the other, but began to leaven it with realization of the feminine dimension of ultimate reality?
Well, the funny thing is we don't even have to speculate on that question. Speculation isn't necessary there in the Christian tradition. When you say, what would happen in theology if we had women at the table as well as men? All you have to do is go back to the template of Jesus. Jesus showed them what would happen. Jesus had women as well as men. The evangelists are very clear about it. They didn't want you to miss the fact that, quote, there were women in the crowd. Time after time after time, the evangelists point out the people who shouldn't be there, the women who Scripture says supported him out of their own substance. In other words, no women benefactors, no Jesus. They recognized him first. They recognized him last. They were there all the way through Jesus' ministry, literally from beginning to end. And it didn't negativize Jesus, did it? It was only later, as the male waters washed in and began to write their story, that her story got left out. The only thing that would happen to religion is it would be deeper, richer, more insightful, more aware, and more like the first community, the early community in the Christian tradition. But whether or not you're Christian, it's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, it would be more like the creation of the human race by the life of life, and we would all be more alive spiritually if we were learning from one another, male and female, instead of having somehow or other to confuse dominance with Christianity, dominance with theology, dominance with insight.
Let me take this in a slightly different direction, although it's not so different really at all. You've emerged as one of the most loved spiritual teachers of our time, as well as intellectual and cultural leaders. And we're interested in the feminine dimension in this context, too. But let me just ask you to say a few words about what it means to actually be on a spiritual path, but especially in a time of growing pluralism, when we can cross those borders you were talking about before, how important it is to cross borders, cross faiths, to save the planet. What's it like, what does it mean for us to be seeking the spiritual in a time of pluralism? And in the spirit, I just want to remind us of our friend Wayne Teasdale and what he called interspirituality.
Yes.
That's my big question.
Yes. Well, if I'm reading your question right, Jim, and thank you for your very loving and kind words. That's beautiful, because I hear a great deal more of those who don't sometimes. But I don't think you will ever, you will not, we will not arrive at our hopes for the planet without the development of a profound spiritual path. It's in spirituality that all the barriers disappear, all the boundaries dissolve. And there are only two dimensions of spirituality. Now remember, I said spirituality. I didn't say theology, and I didn't say religion. Both of those are essential to the maintaining of both the tradition and its growth in the present. But there are two dimensions of spirituality that are of the essence of the transcendence of boundaries and barriers, and that's the contemplative and the mystical. Now, I come from a Benedictine tradition that's over 1,500 years old. The only institution in the Catholic Church that is older is the Church itself. This cenobitic tradition, a contemplative tradition, goes back literally to the formation of the very first religious communities in the West, and it was based totally contemplation on this notion that God wills us all well and not woe, that it is of the essence of godliness and godlikeness that we live. Now, unless you are cultivating that spiritually, unless somehow or other, and I return to an earlier part of this conversation, unless religion itself begins to understand that contemplation and mysticism demand and trigger are the dynamic force behind the meeting of opposites across boundaries and barriers to the point of finding our oneness. Religion separates. Creed and doctrine separate, or at least they have been used that way. Only the recognition of the spiritual and contemplative dimension of the religious tradition can possibly recreate the unity that religion, all religions, have nurtured for centuries. We have the truth. We are the right ones. We know the word. That's not the question. The question is, do you know God? Do you know the Spirit? Do you understand that we are, when we use the word so loosely, brothers and sisters, that we are all one? We have institutionalized our differences. We have created our own barriers and boundaries. Only those who go down into the soul to find its own needs and understand its own values and then recognize those in others can possibly ever really achieve the point at which there are no barriers, there are no boundaries between us. It's of the essence. It can't be. I was always fond of telling our own community years ago that if you do not have a strong spiritual life, if you don't have a good prayer life, you're just another group of do-gooders. And when it doesn't happen, you will soon quit. You'll be tired. You'll wear yourself out. There'll be no energy there. You don't do this to succeed. This is not capitalist Christianity. You don't do this to win. You do this because the contemplative in you, the mystic in you, tells you there is no other way to be truly human. There is no other way to be truly of God. This whole notion of developing the spiritual in people and allowing the catechisms to take care of themselves is the only way forward. This whole notion of spiritual pluralism, go that way, and don't let anybody stop you. Unless and until we are moving always with the other, always, certainly steeped in our own tradition, certainly formed by it in to the best of ourselves, so that we have something to take to other great religious traditions. It can't, all we'll do is go on being fashioners of our own religious ghettos and keeping everybody else out.
I always think about a great British mystic, Douglas Steer, you know, his work well, but who used to talk about mutual irradiation, that somehow what's happening spiritually in that tradition illuminates the darkest corners of mine where I didn't know there was stuff.
That's exactly it, and you have nothing to fear. No, you need not fear losing your own faith. You will only see it taught back to you in the brightest kind of light and in different forms and figures that will give depth and richness to your own.
Well, we've been asking everyone and talking a little bit about this. I just like your thoughts, I'm guessing, but which do you see as more likely, the global spread of fundamentalism or the growth of interreligious pluralism? I think you know my thoughts on this, but what are yours?
Yeah. Well, I really believe that we're well on our way to spiritual pluralism. Having said that, you know, first thing you learn, right, in a good chemistry, every action creates a reaction. For those, in a sense, religious fundamentalism is the proof that religious pluralism is becoming stronger by the day. You have to, you would definitely expect those who for whatever reasons, And there are multiple reasons, and I don't, not necessarily invidious ones, fear, lack of experience, ignorance, the meaning, not stupidity, but the people in groups who haven't had the opportunity to think these things through together in the light of their own scriptures that always transcend the great scriptures always transcend these attempts to divide us. Religious fundamentalism is the lack of that kind of understanding and awareness, and it will be at its worst when spiritual pluralism is at its best. So there's no doubt in my mind, just as we saw this all unfold in the racist arena, it's not going to be any different here, but it will eventually, because it must, simply disappear.
Well, my wife and I, whom you know well, have just returned from conversations with Barbara and others, Hillary, who's on the line today, about a project that has to do, in a nutshell, with the idea that this really is an age of dramatically accelerated evolutionary transformation, and perhaps even especially in the religious and spiritual dimension. What are your thoughts about that? Is that a yay or a nay?
Well, that's definitely a yay. There's no question, though. In fact, evolution itself is now emerging everywhere, not as enemy of religion, but as the liberation of a patriarchal God into the life force and form of the universe. What is evolving here is thanks to science. Science and religion are definitely not enemies. Science is stretching the spiritual mind to a God much greater than the small God we have made for ourselves.
Can you say a word or two more about that? Because so many people think you have to make the choice.
Oh, no. You can't make the choice.
One way or the other.
Oh, no. No, you must not make that choice, ever. What you're seeing evolve theologically is the whole notion that the God of the black box is long dead. That God is dead. And the black box is that notion, that theological notion that so many of us grew up with, that God had a plan for all of us. And the plan was written down and taped into a small black box. God knew what the plan for your life was. Now, you had to figure it out. It was the life's great guessing game. What does God want of me? What does God want to do? That brought you right to the next question. Who's responsible for evil? Must be God who's responsible for evil, because God knew all things. That brought you to the third level of things. Well, if God knows all things, God knows if I'm not going to win the race. So did God condemn me to this thing called hell, or did I condemn me? How we do that? No. What science gives us is this notion of the God of life, who with a great burst of loving energy, created a universe which we now know scientifically. Now, we it's perfectly clear to us that failure is a part of God's plan. It's a great old monastic story. The disciple says to the monk, "What do you do in the monastery?" And the monk says, "Oh, we fall and we get up, and we fall and we get up, and we fall and we get up again." What we see, what science shows us, is that conscious, but limited, and but persistent and loving attempt to move beyond yesterday to a more spiritual tomorrow in each of us is part of God's plan. And that instead of the God of the black box who stands behind us saying, "Got it wrong, gotcha, you got it wrong, you missed again," this God says, come on, you did great yesterday. You did fine. You just keep coming. I'm waiting right here for you. You come. Because when we all get there together, we're going to melt into God in another whole way of life that only the beauty of the universe begins to even imagine for us. No. And this God of evolution is the God who understands us, who created us, who knows our weaknesses, and knows that our greatest strength is our desire to move beyond our weaknesses.
I hope you won't mind if I throw in one of my favorite lines, which is that creation was God saying, "Let there be evolution." And then there's a pause, and God says, "Surprise us."
It's wonderful. God is the God of surprises, and evolution tells us that. It's wonderful. That's exactly right, Jim.
Well, we wind up now. Most of our listeners, Joan, on this call are personally very much engaged in peace and justice work on the local or regional level. Ecological work and that sort of thing. And as you know, that work can be very trying. And I wonder if I think you've already spoken to this, but I wonder if you'd have a final word or two of spiritual counsel for all of those of us who
only
are trying.
Only that
to
we do. Yeah, the word never changes for me, and that is we are doing what we know to be right, and we do not do it for any capitalist reason, meaning success as we would name it. We do it because we must. And that is enough for us. That is our evolution. And we'll learn as we go, and we'll fail as we go. But the success is that we started and we stayed.
Perfect. Thank you so much for this conversation. Don't go away yet. We may have time for a few questions, but I think we would all agree this has really been fantastic.
Well, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to have people to talk to about these things. The conversations from the 19th century do not comfort, do not warm, do not serve, and do not grow. A conversation like this says to me, we started and we'll stay.
Yeah, I want to add my thanks to that, Joan. We want to be in this conversation for the 21st century, and I think everything you said has people on this call, I just know it, so inspired and wound up that it seems like only the beginning of the conversation that we want to continue having with you. And to that
Thank
end,
you.
Just for a few moments, I mean, you are in the camp of the people that you could only dream about talking to, because that's how interested we are in these topics.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm doing a presentation in Phoenix on New World, New God, the one they never told us about.
Wow. Okay. Well, sign me up. I'd like to ask the panelists and also the listeners, the participants on these teleconferences, if they would like to use our system of pressing 1 on your telephone keypad, if you have a question for Sister Joan in case she has to leave us before our panel begins. And we're monitoring that right now.
Yeah, I will have to leave, Barbara. I'm sorry. I'm embarrassed to tell you, but I have another call tonight that I need to prepare for. So, but I'm going to stay for as long as I can. I'm not running out on you.
No, we thank you for that. I would like to just ask a brief question myself while we're monitoring the events coming up. And that has to do with the fact that when you're a very good integrator, it's no problem for you to hold science and spirituality or social action and spirituality and many other institutions of the secular, so-called, and the spiritual at the same time. And I had a proposition that I wanted to run by you that had to do with the fact that we use in our network a term spiritually motivated or spiritually guided social action. Because we know that if it doesn't first begin at a very deep place within the individual and that individual's relationship to his or her own source, that it's not sustainable. It's cosmetic, as you say. And then, on a separate note, I also see that much of the organization of these community social action programs is done by women. And so I'm wondering if that's not a new type of spirituality that's actually emerging in and of itself as the new arena for female leadership.
Yes, you're onto something there, Barbara. I'm sure you are, and you're pointing up another change that we haven't had a chance tonight to deal with a lot, and that's this. I think that what you're talking about when you're talking about this arena for spiritual women and women's spirituality is developing among us, and it is. But it is standing on the shoulders of another movement, and that has been the advancement of lay spirituality. This whole notion that clergy are the church, that clergy define the church and everybody else, clergy are 3% of the church. The church is the church. And this emergence of lay spirituality is so strong. I am so convinced that it is the flower that we're missing, the grass that's coming through the cement that we don't see much, that in 1 month from tonight, I will launch a new movement called the Monastery of the Heart. And what I'm inviting people to do is to form small communities around Benedictine spirituality off of the materials that we'll begin them with, but that they will initiate and they will direct, so that somehow or other we can begin to build a network of lay spiritual communities based on an ancient spirituality, so that it will be perfectly clear that just as in the early church, the laity are the church and are its engine, are its heart, are its mind, and that the function of the clergy is to provide this bridge between the best of ancient spirituality and the needs of contemporary spirituality. In that arena, you will then naturally have women leaders as well as male leaders, and that you will have lay-led groups that and lay-directed groups and lay-initiating groups that take the faith to themselves, but not independent of the great tradition. So, yes, it's all here. It's all coming together. It's like 1,000 streams coming down 1,000 mountains all at once, and ending in this great burst, this great flow, this great tsunami of new spiritual insight. And we have to do everything we can to feed that, because what has been is over and is not working. Can't work in this period at all. Not this period of insight and intuition and need. It can't work any longer. So we must provide something else.
Yeah, we have to agree with you there. I'm going to take a question by Margot McAuliffe. Margot, are you still here?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Yes, sister, I wanted to ask you to recommend one of your books for me to give to a dear African friend who works with the most the greatest victims of the male dominance, which are female sex workers, and she works with them in Kenya. I would love to give her one of your books, and I'm just wondering what you'd recommend.
Well, if she's really working with women and attempting to build their sense of their spiritual selves as well as their personal selves,
yeah,
you might want to get her a book I wrote. It's an older book now. It's 7, 8, 9 years old, but it's still functioning well in groups, called A Heart of Flesh, a feminist spirituality for women and for men.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
it's an Erdman's book, and it's quite accessible. It is very readable.
Okay.
If you write to me, I'll say it quickly, but someone will give it to you. Joanc, Joan C, at attglobal.net.
Okay.
I'll have, or go into joanchittister.org, and you will see the list of materials there. It says contact us. Anybody will help you choose those books.
Okay. All right.
And good luck, and thank you for doing
about
that.
Her. She's a wonderful person, and you and she should know each other. So I maybe will write to you and just give you a little.
Terrific.
Thank you
terrific.
So much.
Thanks, Margot. Thanks for doing that. That's terrific.
Joan, do you have time for one more question, or do you need to?
Sure. Let's take one more, and then I'll start the next.
Deborah Olive, Reverend Deborah Olive, has a question.
Yes, Joan, I'm wondering, from your vantage point, where do you see the greatest hope in terms of women's spirituality emerging?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? I got distracted there for a minute. Go ahead.
Yes,
where do I see
the greatest hope in terms of women's spirituality emerging today?
Do you mean, Deborah, in what arena or around what question?
What I'm thinking of is that you have really a broad perspective in terms of women's spirituality. So perhaps the question is, in what arena do you see
the
greatest hope?
I think that's right. Yes. I think that where I'm seeing women function, including ordained clergy women, we have a number of ordained clergy people, clergy women now. Isn't it interesting to anybody that so many of them have moved out of the institutional structures that they were ordained to serve? Now, there are two possible answers to that. One is they did not find a welcome there. But the second answer is the ordained woman, the spiritual woman, goes directly, almost like an arrow, into the area where the human spirit is broken and begins to minister there. So you find them, they leave these parishes, and they and other women come with them, and they find their way into ghettos and orphanages and hospices and special care units. They're going where the pain is, while the institutional churches are standing there doing the theoretical sermonizing. These women are out ministering to the people. It reminds me a great deal, and some of you would, I think, understand that. It seems to me almost like the emergence of a new kind of 21st century nun. You know, Roman Catholic sisters were always where the pain was. They were on the battlefields and in the hospitals, and with the children left on the streets and the girls who weren't permitted to go to school and to read, they went straight to the lowest point on the ladder and said, "We're here, we're here." That's where I see women going now, and they are drawing around them prayer circles, discussion circles, theology circles. They're moving into the pain and saying, "What's going on here spiritually?" And I'm seeing it everywhere, absolutely everywhere.
Thank you for that.
Thank you so much. We know that you might have to leave, so please feel free any time you need to check out. But we're going to proceed with
yes.
Once again, our most profound thanks for you being here today. It's just the beginning of a very lively conversation, I have a feeling.
Oh, good. Thanks. Great for me, too, Barbara. And I mean, the invitation was a gift itself. I'm going to stay and listen for a while, but then I will slip out quietly and thank all of you who make this possible and who I know will continue it in so many ways.
Thank you.
And thanks from me, Joan. Thank you very much.